Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Journalism, part of the New Books Network. I'm Jenna Spinelli, an instructor in the Donald P. Belisario College of Communications at Penn State, and I am delighted to be joined today by Ken Ellingwood. Ken has reported stories around the world for the Los Angeles Times and is the author of First to Fall, Elijah Lovejoy and the Fight for a Free Press in the Age of Slavery, which was released by Pegasus Books earlier this year. Ken, welcome to the New Books Network. Thanks for joining us.
Really glad to be here.
So let's start with a little bit of an origin story here. How did Elijah Lovejoy come on to your radar, and what was the kernel that you saw that thought, oh, there's something here that's worth exploring?
Well, I probably should have known more about Lovejoy than I did, having grown up in Maine, where he is from. But he didn't really, leave much of a mark on me until after I had spent a long career at the LA Times, and I left the paper in 2012 and went to China because of my wife's job. And I found myself in a Chinese university as a teaching fellow. So I was a guest there and teaching Chinese students about American journalism, including the history of American journalism, which they were very interested in my teaching, kind of to my surprise. So I used that as a way to talk about American history and use journalism as this almost like a character in the course of American history as a player. Elijah Lovejoy came up during a unit that we did on the antebellum period and slavery and the period, leading up to the Civil War, and looking at how newspapers were dealing with that and how some were speaking out against slavery. And to my delight and surprise, my students, the Chinese students, raised, of course, in a regime where freedom of the press is, really, it's there on paper, but it doesn't exist in a real way in China. We're really taken by Lovejoy's story, and we were doing a fairly short unit on Lovejoy, but I was very struck by their reaction to him and how they saw him really as a hero. And I wanted them to see that while they may think that Americans, were born with a, silver spoon in the mouth, that we were granted all these rights at the beginning of the country, that they actually had to be fought for over time. And I was hoping, and it worked, really, that my students would see the Lovejoy story as a kind of an inspiration to them to fight their own battles. And so out of this experience in a place where there isn't freedom of the press, I was inspired to dig deeper into a story that is about a hero of freedom of the press in America. And it got me digging into Lovejoy's life and story.
Yeah, and I really enjoy how the book is sort of split between, as you said, telling Lovejoy's story and the kind of broader story of press freedoms at that time. And I want to, you know, definitely come back to the press freedom side of things, but let's dig into Lovejoy's story a little more first. So he, as you said, grew up in Maine. His family themselves were not slaveholders. Maine was not a slave state. So how did this issue come on to his radar? And can you also talk about his evolution? I understand he maybe started off at a more incrementalist view and then sort of became more radical. I don't know if that's the right term over time, but his views grew more fervent over time, perhaps.
Yeah. So let's set the period as well. Lovejoy was born in 1802 in a town that is now called Albion in central Maine. And he grew up in a very religious family. His father was a Congregationalist minister. His mother was not formally trained, but was very very well schooled in religion and was very devout and had grown up in a household herself where she was exposed to a lot of biblical teaching. And so he grew up in a family where there was a strong code of right and wrong and a strong sense of religious duty. And I think it was always sort of, you know, he was the eldest. It was always in the back of his mind that he would probably go into the clergy at some point. He was a very smart kid, learned to read very early, and went on to college at Waterville College, which is now Colby College in Waterville, Maine, and graduated at the top of his class. And then, like a lot of young men at the time, set out to the West to find his, you know, his future, and thinking he might somehow make a living with words, you know, writing. He was a poet and a writer, and he took it seriously. So he ends up going to the far West, which at that time was the Mississippi River, which is St. Louis. And so, you know, it's the Midwest now, but at the time it was the frontier. And it was where a lot of action was happening. A lot of migration was taking place, both internal migration inside the United States, Americans moving to the West, but also foreigners coming from Europe and moving to that area too. So it was an area of a lot of, you know, turmoil, a lot of growth, a lot of activity. And he wanted to be a part of that, in part because of his religious beliefs. And he believed, as some of his elders back at Waterville College would have told him, that this is an area in need of religious shepherding. He becomes the editor of a newspaper there, a secular newspaper, nothing to do with religion whatsoever. And it was a very conventional newspaper at the time. It took a very strong political line. It favored the Whig Party at the time, which is led by, embodied by Henry Clay. And he was not particularly interested in the slavery issue at first. And we're talking about maybe the late 1820s, 1830. He becomes more committed to, you know, his own religious health. And he experiences a religious conversion in St. Louis. It was a period when a lot of people were going to revival meetings, and there were a lot of conversions at the time, some camp meetings and smaller sessions. And he was part of a smaller group. He goes to Princeton Theological Seminary. He decides that he will become a minister. And upon leaving Princeton, joins these two parts of himself. He's an editor and he's a minister. And he turns those two parts of himself into a whole when he goes back to St. Louis to run a religious newspaper, a Presbyterian newspaper called The Observer. And at the time, he doesn't take a very strong stance on slavery. In his earlier role as a newspaper editor for the secular newspaper, he had really no interest in slavery. But he increasingly, in his time in St. Louis, becomes more interested in the issue. Remember, Missouri is a slave state. There is slave trading going on around him. He is, you know, witness to it. He is witness to, you know, people in chains being, you know, sold as as property and put on boats down the river. So he becomes interested in the issue, but from a very kind of gradualist point of view. He was more interested in the religious nourishment of enslaved people rather than, you know, outright liberation for them. As time would go on, he would grow more fervent in his beliefs that slavery was a first, you know, a curse, and then he saw it as a sin that had to be eradicated.
Right. And that eventually drives him out of St. Louis, right, to Alton, Illinois.
Right. The messages that he begins to write in the St. Louis Observer are not well received in the city. This is a city that does a lot of trading with the South. It is really part of the South. And the powers that be, the elites in town and many others, saw him as a troublemaker and somebody who needed to be silenced. As his writings in the newspaper became more fervent, and as he began to include the writings of abolitionist groups back east in his newspaper, he was seen as a dangerous figure. And it bears remembering here that abolitionists in general were seen as wild-eyed radicals. This is not a period yet in the 1830s where, you know, calling for the immediate end of slavery, calling for the liberation of 2.5 million, you know, people in chains, was something that people were really, other Americans who were really ready to talk about or tolerate. He was harassed, and threatened, and it became clear that he couldn't stay in St. Louis and live to tell about it. He moved with his wife and infant son across the river to Illinois, to the city of Alton. Because Illinois is a free state, he figured that it would be, you know, he would be free to write what he wanted to. And because it was a free state, he said at the time that he didn't really see a need necessarily to write about slavery all that much. Well, as it turned out, he did continue to write about slavery. And as it turned out, being in a free state there along the border, right, with the slavery South, was really offered no more protection against the harassment and threats than he had in St. Louis. He was back in the same boat again, under threat, being harassed and being pressured on many sides by those who wanted him to stop writing about slavery.
Right. And this leads to his printing press being destroyed multiple times.
Multiple times. He just would not give up. He just wouldn't get the message. On the very day when he is moving from St. Louis to Illinois, he's announced it in the newspaper. He said, "I'm leaving here. I see better prospects on the other side of the river." And he on the very day when he's announced that he's leaving, that, you know, a mob, you know, trashes his newspaper office. He manages to rescue the press and get it across the river to Alton, where it is destroyed on the riverbank on the Alton side. So his welcome to Alton was, you know, "Hello, we've now destroyed your printing press, and it's time for you to start again." He would lose 3 printing presses to mob attacks in the next year or so. And each time his allies and friends there, his financial backers, would help him buy a replacement press. And as we're now in 1836 and into 1837, as the mob attacks grew more severe, more threatening, really more dangerous to him, he declined to stop. You know, he declined to what they wanted, which is to stop writing about slavery. They made the same demands in Illinois as they had in St. Louis, and he just refused. He said, "It is my right as an American, and as a, you know, product of God, to print what I want to print, and this is what I can do, and I will continue to do it."
Right. This I think gets into the free press aspects of some of this. I mean, there is, I think, this culture that you describe of mobism at the time and people sort of taking the law into their own hands. Can you talk more about what that was like and how common things like what Lovejoy experienced were for people in media at that time?
Yeah. First of all, there was no period like this period of the 1830s and never has been since when it comes to mob violence, riots, and orchestrated attacks by mobs. The high point was really of that was really the time when Lovejoy was coming under attack himself. He, you know, kind of is an emblem victim of that. There were many reasons for the rise in mob violence in America. For one thing, there were really no police in a lot of these places. Certainly, you know, where he was out on the frontier, it was really kind of the Wild West. And in other cities as well, there were, you know, inter-ethnic rivalries. There were essentially gangs that fought against each other. There were religious-based attacks. But the most common, the most frequent target of mob violence were people who were trying to mobilize sentiment against slavery. Abolitionists were the leading target. And so you've got this person speaking this belief in a place where it's unpopular at a time when the incidence of mob violence is at its absolute peak in American history. And so that's, needless to say, a pretty bad combination of factors. And he's alone. So he wasn't the only one to suffer, you know, these attacks. As I said, there were anti-slavery activists, even in the North, even on the East Coast. You know, it is easily forgotten or overlooked that there was a lot of pro-slavery sentiment in the North as well, just as racism as well. And so there were a lot of people who wanted in the North, who wanted abolitionists to, to be quiet, just as there was a lot of support for the anti-slavery movement in the North. But I think Lovejoy shows, at least where he was geographically, that there was really little difference between being in a slave state and being in a free state when they were both really so close together. It was a pretty rough time.
Right. So if I could pause the historical narrative here for a second and bring us to the present, you know, people who talk about things like cancel culture, for example, often talk about Twitter mobs and these types of things. And it feels to me that word mob is chosen very deliberately to kind of evoke some of what you were just describing. I mean, knowing this history that you do and about what, you know, things that people like Lovejoy went through, how do you think about, you know, people talking about, you know, mobs in this kind of present day social media context?
Well, you know, I'm a journalist and a First Amendment fan, and I tend to err on the side of expression. There's quite a difference between, you know, saying something on a social media and attacking somebody's body or home, which is what he was facing at the time. So what concerns me more in the present day context, I would say, as a journalist and as a somebody who has lived and had a career that was built on freedom of the press, is the climate that we have seen develop around, looking at journalists as the enemy. You know, we've just endured a presidency where, you know, journalists were supposedly the enemies of the people, and where, you know, people who are free and independent journalists are, you know, denigrated as, you know, as fake news, and where the whole point of independent, you know, journalistic inquiry is seen in some ways, you know, as unpatriotic. And that's what worries me a lot more, to be honest. It's that the practice of journalism. Yeah, look, I've worked in around the world, and I've worked in some very dangerous places, as many of my colleagues have, and I admire them all for that. We expect that. When you're in, you know, covering a war in Iraq, you expect that there's risk. You know that when you are reporting on, you know, the drug war in Mexico, as I did, there are risks to that. There are people who don't want you to report things. They don't want you to go places. But what disturbs me is that the practice of journalism has become more dangerous in the United States. And you can see in the coverage, the news coverage, the very honest, you know, earnest news coverage of the protests that we saw last year after the Floyd killing, that journalists were attacked by authorities, they needlessly, and it was obvious that they were being targeted. And so I am concerned that the climate has become rather antagonistic toward journalists and journalism. And I think the Lovejoy story, to go back to that, is a reminder to us that these freedoms are fragile, and we shouldn't take them for granted. And we, you know, people have sacrificed a lot to get us here, and we should protect that.
Right. And you also make the point in the book that, you know, a lot of the sort of press freedoms from a legal perspective that we know, like New York Times v. Sullivan in these cases, were obviously not in place during Lovejoy's time either. So can you talk more about what the legal environment, or perhaps lack thereof, was during his time?
One of the things that really impressed me is as I looked into Lovejoy's story and learned more about the context in which he was operating, is that he was operating on faith, a belief that the press is free. And a lot of other editors of his time were doing the same thing. They didn't really have proof of that belief. That's why I say it was faith. There was a First Amendment, you're right, to the Constitution, but it had never been really tested. No, there were no court rulings saying that, you know, you can do this and you can't do that. The press is protected in this case, it's not protected in that. Those rulings that really kind of expanded the press's ability to do what we do really came in the 20th century. And in Lovejoy's time, there was just a belief that the press was free. And newspaper editors at the time surely acted as if they were free. They wrote mean things about each other because the newspapers almost always had a partisan attachment. And they threw, you know, insults at each other. They fought each other physically in the street at times. There were duels. I mean, it was a pretty rough trade being a newspaper editor. But you get out of this kind of free-for-all the sense that, hey, these guys, they really believed that the press is free. They really believed that they can, you know, write what they want to write. And then you come to an issue like slavery, where suddenly, no, that's not the case. You know, they can't do that. So I admire Lovejoy, or I grew to admire him as I looked into him and his story, because he was operating in this gray area. There was a First Amendment, but there were no real concrete decisions or actions that anybody could really point to say you are protected, and you can write what you want to write. And really, when you look back at this, the abolition movement, the anti-slavery movement, was really the first test of freedom of the press and freedom of speech. You know, the really first challenge about what that meant and how far it extended.
Yeah, and there's some interesting issues of federalism, right, where the court said that yes, the federal government cannot intervene as the First Amendment dictates, but states are basically free to do whatever they want, which they did.
Correct. I mean, during his time, the states held sway. Whatever happened at the state level was really the dominant ethos, right? The states had libel laws, and they could regulate what the press could say. What we saw during the 1830s was a whole burst of laws passed by states in the South that, in order to protect slavery, they actually passed laws that outlawed the publication of any kind of materials, you know, newspapers or pamphlets or anything that challenged slavery. They considered that to be fostering or inciting insurrection by enslaved people. So they outlawed it and they put severe, you know, penalties on it. So the states were really the, you know, the 800-pound gorilla in those times. And that would remain the case until the passage of the 14th Amendment after the Civil War. That's when really the rights that we see in the Bill of Rights were in a sense nationalized, if you will. And so in Lovejoy's time, he and other editors were operating in a somewhat of an unclear environment.
And were they also able to use the postal service to get around some of this? I was thinking about that in just in terms of, you know, the kind of freedom that brings versus our environment today, where it's private companies that are responsible for what gets shared or not, or disseminated or not.
You know, we don't think about this, but the press owes a lot to the post office. For the early success of the media. I mean, the American people were already big fans of newspapers even before independence, and some newspapers played a role in the, you know, the quest for independence. Early Americans were really news junkies, and they loved their papers. And the post office, when the post office law was passed in the 1790s, you know, not long after the country got started. The news industry got a big boost because the post office charged a very low price to move newspapers around. So what would happen is that editors would subscribe to each other's newspapers and they would mail them around to each other. So you'd have newspapers, bags and bags of newspapers stacked on wagons being moved around this new and expanding country from one end to the other. And it served as a kind of glue, you know, for the country. It helped people in Missouri, for example, to know what was happening back in, you know, Virginia or Maryland or so. So it was the post office played a big role in helping to foster a national trade in newspapers, even as early as, you know, as Lovejoy's time in the 1830s. And he was getting newspapers, and part of what changed him, what turned him into more of a outspoken and more of an ambitious, you know, anti-slavery activist, was what he was reading from newspapers that were coming from the East, because he was really kind of alone out there on the frontier. So the post office played a big role in moving the words around the country. If you took a bag of mail at the time and you dumped it on the ground, you know, 90% of the weight of it would be newspapers. It's really what we were doing. The post office also came into play when the abolitionist, organized abolitionist movement in the Northeast tried to penetrate the South with journals and pamphlets that were mailed to the South, and those were often intercepted, burned. There was a real controversy over whether the abolitionist groups in the North should even be allowed to put those things into the mail. The South did a pretty good job of shutting out word of really any kind of word that was critical of slavery. That was a big effort of the Southern states and Southern politicians.
Right. So jumping forward in the story, can you talk about how Lovejoy ultimately meets his demise and sort of what the kind of immediate reaction or aftermath was from the abolitionist community?
So over the course of maybe 16 months or so in Alton, Illinois, you know, things just go from bad to worse. He's greeted, as I mentioned before, by having his press broken on the riverbank. He gets a new one. There's a quiet period, but then, you know, he starts up again with his anti-slavery columns. And he is met by resistance, and sort of each time he's met by threats to stop or you know, noisy requests to stop, he just gets more determined than ever that he's going to continue publishing. And he becomes so he starts off being this, you know, a minister, and he's voicing this anti-slavery line, but that position becomes really one part and parcel of a larger message of press freedom. They become really the same. He braids these two positions together, anti-slavery and freedom of the press. And so he gets, you know, harassed more, attacked in his wife's family's house, you know, threatened with being tarred and feathered on the road. It just continues on, and he never he relents. He just keeps publishing. Ultimately, he's lost three presses by late 1837 and orders a fourth press after a bunch of community meetings, and everybody's trying to find a way out of this mess. And he's just determined to take this to the end if necessary. And this, remember, a man who was married, he had a child and another child on the way. And yet he was willing to continue to stand up. The fourth press is delivered from a boat, a riverboat, spirited into a warehouse of a friend of his, and guarded by a couple dozen of Lovejoy's friends and other people. They managed to round up, and they were, you know, they were armed inside that warehouse. They had muskets, and they were ready to defend this this press, you know, at the expense of their lives. The mob organized, that had already been on the lookout for this press, organizes, and a bunch of them amass outside the warehouse. The crowd grows. The, you know, much whiskey is drunk during this episode. People are armed. Then rocks are thrown. Then gunshots are fired, and pretty soon you've got an all-out riot going on in and around this warehouse. The crowd is demanding that Lovejoy and his people give up the press. They refuse to. The mob begins to set the warehouse on fire. So now Lovejoy and his people are besieged inside a burning building, and he emerges from a door on one end of the warehouse, armed, to clear the person who's setting fire to the roof on a ladder. But as Lovejoy comes out of his building, or out of his friend's building, the warehouse, he's hit with multiple gunshots fired by at least two gunmen who were part of the mob, who stationed themselves outside the door. He stumbles back inside the warehouse, recognizes that he's been hit, and falls dead inside the warehouse. His friends surrender at that point. It's obvious that this thing has gone far enough. And the crowd outside, you know, storms the warehouse. They get the press that they were looking for, and they smash it to bits. And Lovejoy is, you know, converted in a sense from this, you know, fairly obscure figure out on the frontier fighting a losing battle, I suppose, on his own, to becoming a martyr. He is you know, becomes the first martyr to the free press in America. Mm-hmm. And in the North, it really triggers a reaction that was quite emotional. People were horrified that a newspaper editor would be killed for the words that he was writing. And it was a bit of a wake-up call for Northerners that the rights that they, and I'm talking about white Northerners now, the rights that they took for granted or assumed that they held were being threatened by the South as well, by this idea that one can't speak out against slavery, that there were some limits to the freedom of speech in the press that they believed were, you know, ironclad in the First Amendment. So it mobilized people. It sort of took a bit of the demon coloration off of the abolitionist movement. It widened it a bit. Mm-hmm. And most of all, I would say that it served to expand or promote a modern view of what journalism and the press should be in America, which is to say a place where you can write and publish unpopular views, and that's part of the democratic discourse. That's part of what we do.
Did the paper continue on after Lovejoy's death?
It didn't really. It there were some faltering attempts to save it, but it was done. Yeah, it was gone. So if the mob wanted to, you know, shut Lovejoy up, they did. If they wanted to end his newspaper, they did. But at the same time, you know, he becomes the symbol, which maybe has more power than he did as a newspaper editor.
Yeah, and there were other people watching. I think you mentioned at the end of the book that Abraham Lincoln was in the Illinois legislature at this time. And so, you know, he's seeing it. Of course, Alton becomes the site of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, right? So it seems like it might also be sort of an early marker for the larger run-up to the Civil War.
Yeah, Lincoln takes note of it and laments the you know, that a newspaper editor could be killed and press is thrown in the river. In a fairly eloquent passage, John Quincy Adams, the former president, who was at the time a congressman from Massachusetts, you know, says this is Lovejoy's killing was like an earthquake, you know, across the country, that it you know, it struck with that much force. That was, you know, clearly some hyperbole. It didn't really mobilize the country, you know, against slavery. That would have to come later, and only war would end that. But it really made an impact, and it made Lovejoy into a real powerful symbol for press freedom.
Right. So the other aspect, thinking about, you know, press during Lovejoy's time and what has evolved since, and you talk a little bit about this in the book. There's this, as you said, there was this very, it was a partisan press. You know, newspapers had a particular point of view, and then of course that has evolved into what we've come to know as objective journalism. And now there's some within the academy and within parts of the profession saying that maybe it's time to go back to a more partisan press model. So knowing what you know about Lovejoy's time and your own experience, of course, with the Los Angeles Times, what do you think about that? Or, you know, where do you sort of see things going moving forward?
Well, I can see that. And it is a point that it was an observation that I made to my students in China at the time, that what you are seeing is a kind of a return to that era. I mean, the sources of information, I don't know that I would call all of them journalism, because journalism to me has a specific meaning. It requires, you know, people to be involved in the practice of verification, for one thing, which is a very important to me, a very important ingredient, a very important requirement. But you can see that at least the American audience for media is certainly being fragmented by ideology and by, you know, by partisan beliefs. I'm, I guess, an old school type in that I continue to believe that our democracy is best served by, you know, a free and independent press, obviously, but one where, you know, you can depend on the fact that the information has been verified, and that there has been a great deal of care taken to make sure that this is complete and thorough and you know, and free of bias. I just don't think I'll ever give up on that belief.
Right. Yeah, no, fair enough. And it is, I think it will be a debate for years, if not longer, to come in the industry moving forward.
I don't know that, you know, when you look back on the time of the partisan press, I'm not sure that anybody would necessarily consider that a golden age of American journalism. Mm. You know, there was a lot of meanness. There was a lot of kind of gratuitous, just sort of hurling of insult and all that. But while it was important that the country go through that stage in order to, you know, solidify what it wanted as a press, I don't think that we, you know, pine for those days.
Right. Yeah. And it's a completely different media landscape too, with social media and the whole other thing. We could spend another hour talking about that. Yeah. But so Ken, if folks, I certainly hope that they'll read your book and learn more about Lovejoy's story. Are there other resources you would recommend for folks who want to learn more about journalism during this kind of abolitionist era?
There's a character in the book who's kind of a co-star, and his name is James Burney. And I struggled, I have to say, as in writing the book, with how big a part to give him, because he's a terrific character. And he was doing the same thing Lovejoy was doing, but he was doing it in Cincinnati. And he ends up becoming a rather interesting character in a different way, in that he survived some of the same kinds of attacks that Lovejoy didn't survive. And he goes on to become a political figure. He takes his anti-slavery activism into politics. He runs for president twice. And he may have spoiled the election in 1844. I mean, he may have been the spoiler as a third party candidate. And I think that, you know, Bernie's a great story to look into, and he's evidence that there were people at the time. Needless to say, William Lloyd Garrison is probably the most famous during Lovejoy's time. Later, Frederick Douglass is absolutely well deserved for all the praise that, you know, and attention he gets. But he wasn't yet active as an editor during Lovejoy's time. But in the 1830s, there were other editors who were trying to use newspapers to fight against this pernicious institution of slavery. And I think it's a pretty rich field. I was pleased to see, as a storyteller, that the Lovejoy story hadn't been told for quite a long time, and had not been told in a modern way that I wanted to tell it. It reads like a modern day narrative story, and and so Lovejoy, you know, has been overlooked for a long, long time. But I think he deserves the attention, and there are other editors out there who deserve the same kind of praise and support.
Yeah, and there you're right. There are so many other characters and elements that we did not get to talk to or to talk about today. But I hope folks will check them out. What's next for you, Ken? What else are you working on?
Well, I'm really just working on raising attention to this story and hoping that people will see in Lovejoy's story a reason to care about the climate that journalists face now. You asked me earlier about resources. I think some of the resources that I would hope people would look into are those having to do with the current, climate of press freedom. The Committee to Protect Journalists is one. You know, there are various press freedom organizations out there that put out really good material and keep track of the kinds of attacks on the press that we've seen in recent years. And those are really, really great resources. I hope people check those out, as they're reading First to Fall.
Yeah, great. Well, great. Well, we will leave it there. And again, Ken's book is called First to Fall, Elijah Lovejoy and the Fight for a Free Press in the Age of Slavery, which is out now from Pegasus Books. Ken, thanks so much for joining us today.
It was really my pleasure. Thanks a lot.